Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by the host with the most, the Hall of Famer, the difference maker, Mr. Tony Sager. Tony, how are you, sir?
Great, Sean. It's great to be back and a great topic today.
Absolutely. We're joined by the director of the critical security controls here at CIS, Charity. Charity, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Great to be back. Thanks, Sean.
Absolutely. Great to have you back. Fantastic. And a associate technical fellow at Verizon Business Group, a former employee of CIS, the prodigal child has returned, Phil Langlois. Sir, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. It's a pleasure to be back amongst the family.
Absolutely. And so, Phil, just give us a little bit of background, because as a co-author of the Verizon Data Breach Investigation Report that's just been released, so thank you for that. Can you just give us a little bit of your background and what you're seeing in terms of both the report, and then we're going to dive into some of the key findings.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm the lead data scientist for the Verizon Data Breach Investigations Report. I've been on the team for about 7 years now. So I do the majority of the technical research, and which involves a lot of collaboration with industry partners, much like the fine folks here at CIS, to kind of help provide the cybersecurity landscape, right? This is really a community project. This is why we find ourselves in good company here with the folks at CIS. Because they kind of show this mentality as well. So, you know, I work with a lot of different vendors, partners, to really provide this view. And prior to joining Verizon, I was at CIS and I worked with Tony on the CIS critical security controls. And even prior before that, I was at the MSISAC, where I did some work to help support the state and local territorial and tribal government. Yeah, it's just been a series of adventures that eventually led me here, but always not too far from CIS.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Now, in the report itself, and Tony, I don't know that we go an episode now without mentioning the effect of AI, but it seems that there's elements of that, especially with the exploitation of vulnerabilities. Are you seeing the same thing, Phil, in terms of the interpretation of the results, some of the key findings? Is this the AI effect that we're seeing as part of really the data and the data analysis and the work that you have done in the team?
Yeah, so one of the major findings that we had in this year's report was this increase in exploitation of vulnerabilities as one of the main initial access vectors. So it's been growing in the last couple of years, but this year it's definitely taken off, right? And it's now the most common vector in, right? Where previously in the last couple of years, you'd seen credential abuse as being one of the primary ones. Now it is the primary one, and accounts for about 31% of our breaches. We tend to stray a little bit away from, you know, assigning causalities, right? There's a lot of different possible explanations as to why there's an increase in terms of exploitation of vulnerability. One of which is there's just a lot of vulnerabilities this year, right? Or previous years. And there's been kind of this increase, whether or not this is tied back to something like AI is something we don't necessarily have visibility into. But, you know, what is happening is this kind of this downstream impact where organizations have a lot of vulnerabilities they have to identify and patch. And the issue is that it's becoming harder for them to kind of keep up. And adversaries are very efficient at creating exploit code. It's a lot easier to create exploit code than it is to identify and have the meetings with change management board and go through the process of patching a lot of these vulnerabilities. So, you know, previous years, we've kind of reported the median day for exploitation for some of these CISA KEVs was about 9 days, right? And our ability to patch is significantly slower than that. So attackers are able to really kind of leverage their agility to be able to kind of set up scanning infrastructure, look for these vulnerabilities. And, you know, they've been getting a lot of success because there hasn't been a lack of vulnerabilities in VPN technologies or file transfer applications, right? Which by their nature have to be exposed to the internet. So they make very juicy targets for attackers.
Absolutely. And we've even had reflections, Tony, with respect to Mythos and all the, you know, the generation of known exploitation and vulnerabilities. And what are we doing? You know, do we have to react very quickly? We've got to speed up. Does this affect how we implement the controls? Things of that nature. There's a lot to say with the data in hand from the Verizon Data Breach Investigation Report that really then helps build elements towards that community defense model as well. Any thoughts there, Tony?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this trend of, right, the exploitation of the vulnerabilities. And in the past, I think we're starting to see the early days of a shift here, where vulnerabilities previously might have been scarce and, you know, building the exploit was tedious. That time is compressing pretty rapidly now, which gives the attacker more options and more creative freedom, right, to think. And the belief that there's always going to be more vulnerabilities. But, you know, there's an old saw in the business, right, that attackers are natural system thinkers. So they look broadly at the target and they're not, you know, they pick what works. So Phil's observation, right, you know, if credential abuse is the sort of payoff, then they do that. If it's exploiting new vulnerabilities and that seems to be the route that works, then let's go that way. So it's sort of economic thinking, right, natural thinking and looking at the system and seeing where the weaknesses are that makes sense from their point of view. And this is something to remember. Attackers have a life cycle. They have a risk model. They have, you know, they have to think about such things. But Charity, how is that reflected then? You know, because the traditional ways of thinking about defense really are under strain now. As I think Sean has talked about the additional stressors on defense. And what does that mean for the kind of work that you guys do in providing guidance?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it does go back to vulnerability management. You know, it fails when it's everybody's job and nobody's job. So to me, maybe not so much a shift of responsibilities, right? But the documentation and training of identified accountable persons, right? So one of the pieces for me when I was going over the data is, you know, critical known exploited vulnerabilities, you know, organizations are still not remediating fast enough. And Phil had touched on that a few minutes ago, right? Attackers aren't guessing. Like you say, Tony, they're using and reusing what works over and over. You've told me many times that attackers don't like change. They want to rely on what they know works. But I do think that it forces a responsibility conversation. You know me, I always take it back to governance, and this is really governance. There should be clear responsibilities identified in your policy or in your process for who does what, when, and how to report it. So vulnerability management can't live as it, you know, has maybe in the past, a securities problem, securities spreadsheet anymore, while everyone else treats patching as optional or whenever you can get to it, right? So in terms of IG1, you want obvious owners for who finds issues, who decides priority, and that can be the who in your governing documents, who patches and who verifies what's actually fixed. So back to your what you had said, Tony, it's really a life cycle, right? And as you mature, you can make it measurable with those SLAs, like known exploited vulnerabilities get fixed in X amount of days, right? Plus a real exception process that would justify any drift in those SLAs.
And yeah, that's right, Charity. But you know, Phil, you hinted, right, that you might be seeing the beginning of a wave of behavior change by the attackers. Is that how you're interpreting what you're seeing?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that we were able to do this year, which is pretty novel, is we were able to work with one of the frontier labs to specifically analyze the abuse cases, the cybersecurity abuse cases that they had collected over the course of a year. So that allows us to kind of pick apart what techniques were these attackers researching, right? As using either the online platform or coding agent or agentic framework, right? To research, you know, what were they looking for? What capabilities were they looking to enhance? And what we found was that the majority of them kind of fall within, you know, a small number of things, right? Like 15 different techniques, right? Was the median amount for these attackers, which we can take into consideration something like the MITRE ATT&CK framework, which there's hundreds of different techniques. It really shows that there's kind of a concentration of what attackers are leveraging AI to do, right? And ultimately, what we wanted to really understand is how novel are these techniques that they're researching, right? Are they looking for these obscure, technique or use cases that we defenders don't really fully understand or don't have good telemetry or don't have good defenses around? And what we found was actually quite the inverse, right? The majority of the techniques that they were researching were well understood techniques, right? These were things that have existed for a while. There's a lot of existing code and there's a lot of examples for them to draw on, which, you know, kind of makes sense because that's one of the strong suits of a lot of these AI, platforms and these AI bots, is that it's really kind of distilling existing knowledge into, you know, something. So we see a lot of, you know, can you rewrite my downloader to NIM, or can you rewrite it to some other language, or, you know, I want this code to now do process injection. Process injection has been around for a while now, right? It's well understood. There's hundreds of examples of it. We as defenders know what to look for. We're really kind of seeing this, this increase of capabilities of bringing people up to kind of like an average level, right? Where kind of, you know, the more typical type of attackers, right? We're not looking at a whole lot of novelty in the sense of the techniques they're leveraging. Of course, this might be something that changes. There's a whole lot of, you know, capabilities of these AI platforms and these AI systems changes pretty much monthly. So it's kind of hard to know exactly what the next couple months are going to bring. But we see kind of this, increasing of towards the median, right, where everyone can have their malware written. We see ransomware being written in AI that's not able to successfully encrypt the files. It deletes them if they're a certain size. But the attackers that are well-educated, right, they're able to kind of increase a little bit of the scope of what they're doing.
Excellent. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got to talk about ransomware. We've got to talk about shadow AI, some of the research and applied data science that Phil has been doing, and then how CIS is contributing to this year's DBIR. With that, we'll be right back.
Ever feel like cybersecurity is a giant jigsaw puzzle and someone forgot to give you the corner pieces?
Or the box lid, the table, all the time?
Exactly. That's where the CIS Secure Suite platform comes in.
It's your intuitive starting point for cybersecurity. One dashboard with the functionality of SysCap Pro dashboard and CIS CSET Pro built in.
From policy to implementation, it puts the puzzle together for you. CIS controls, check. CIS benchmarks, double check.
And it's built for CIS Secure Suite members. You're getting a streamlined experience with the guidance that turns data into decisions.
Like seeing where your biggest risks are and knowing exactly what to do next. Share results easily with internal security teams from one great tool.
Plus, it helps you align with frameworks like NIST and ISO, making you audit ready.
Whether you're a small team or a cyber underdog, the platform gives you the visibility, clarity, and confidence to act.
So if you're ready to stop guessing and start securing, visit cisecurity.org/SecureSuite to learn more.
CIS Secure Suite Platform. Cybersecurity simplified.
Okay, we're back. And Phil, when we left off, you'd mentioned some thoughts that's leading me down the ransomware findings from the report. Again, very popular. A drop in payouts, though. Now, is this a trend we're starting to see? One, it's successful. Again, I always align to Tony's mention of the economics and the life cycle, as it were, of the attacker. They have their own constraints, their own risks, and the application in this space. But when we see the data and we can then infer certain elements from that, are we seeing, one, there's still success? Let's lower those payments because there are success and we get, you know, an element of a demand supply chain curve, as it were. Are we starting to see that in the data?
So it's complicated because there's so many different trends we're trying to pull apart, right? So we're continuing to see an increase in ransomware victims, right? These ransomware actors are still, you know, conducting these very large operations, right? The number of victims hasn't decreased. Right, it's still increasing at some level, but the amount that's being paid is decreasing, and the percentage of organizations willing to pay is decreasing. So something that we've been kind of learning as we're going through this analysis process is that there's a certain level of distrust you have to take with attacker data, right? Where they're claiming certain victims and things like that, because they have an interest in presenting themselves as the most successful ransomware group, because the affiliates and the folks that are conducting the attacks are really the ones that are generating the revenue for them, right? Because they take a percentage of a cut. So we see a lot of these groups that are also kind of providing, you know, fake victims as part of their, you know, their wall of shame to kind of indicate that, oh yeah, you know, we're the best. Look, this month alone, we've taken down 500. But when you actually start looking at it, there's one that was rehashed from another group. This one's not even a real company. So it ends up kind of being difficult to really get a accurate number as to the number of victims totally. But what we can do is look a little bit in terms of, like I said, the payments of the organizations that were impacted to a degree in which they engaged with negotiators, right? And we've seen that decrease. So these are already kind of the worst cases. And then it's also, you know, the amount that's being paid out. So, you know, we work with a lot of firms that are tracking the ransomware payments, and we see this kind of decrease as well over time. And when we started to look at the actual numbers of total victims to like payments, we found it's about like 9%, you know, was like a success rate for the ransomware, where only about 9% of the victims or 9% of these cases would result in a payment to them. So they have an incentive to cast these really large nets, right? To try to get as many organizations as possible and just to hope that one of them pays out. And you see some certain groups are starting to specialize in these kind of high impact attacks, you know, something like Shiny Hunter and Team PCP is kind of another example, right? Where they have a very developed funnel and process, and they've found kind of a way of collecting that and being able to target and hit a lot of large organizations. So, you know, they're trying to increase their success, but, you know, they're also not the norm, right? We see a lot of Quillen, you know, just kind of traditional type of ransomware, where it's drop the payload and hope that someone pays, right? They move on to the next target.
Yeah, Phil, just to, you know, to pull out a line I've used often, right? That if you want to study capitalism, you study bad guys, not good guys. And there is a certain Darwinian efficiency here, right? That they're looking for what works, right? They're not, elegance is not the issue. The issue is return on investment. So I think it's a really thoughtful analysis you guys do about. But you know, one of the big topics, and Charity, over to you, around third-party exposure. So this is something I know they study extensively with the Verizon report, and is, you know, is a problem that has grown dramatically and isn't slowing down, right? The risk of service providers, suppliers, et cetera. Any thoughts around the role of controls and is there any thinking about that in terms of the expansion of the footprint and the threat surface through all this?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if the question is around will risk continue without vendor control improvements, quick answer is yes. You know, when your vendor gets breached, you're still the one cleaning up the mess, right? This is something in former positions I had a hard time explaining. Often it gets confused with risk transference, right? You've brought in a trusted vendor to provide services and oftentimes make the mistake of, well, this is their entire business. They know more about it than I do, and fall into that trust trap. So not saying that our third parties don't have integrity, but do you know what their security best practices are? And how are you going to be notified of an incident? This is something that I was constantly on the hook for, right? So even if it's not a breach, an incident that renders your services unavailable is still a risk to your reputation and your business model. So I can't emphasize enough the importance of third-party assessment and really knowing what you're assessing, right? You're essentially allowing them to do business on your behalf. So think of them as an extension of how you would run your own shop. And what risks are you trying to mitigate? Think things like MFA, weak passwords, or misconfigurations that linger for months on end can be crippling to an organization. And we see that in the report as well, right? So I don't see this risk slowing down unless we get more serious about vendor expectations. So I always, you know, of course, push for essential cyber hygiene found in implementation group one, but also on the side of that, hold them accountable to IG1 as well and how you are approaching that assessment and accountability.
Yeah, I'm going to look into my crystal ball. Next year, I guarantee we're probably going to be talking about third parties again, right? It's such a complex issue. And we've been trying to pull the thread in so many different ways, right? Like, how can we accurately capture, you know, these downstream impacts? And something to keep an eye on in June is we're working on a breach impact study, right? Where we're pulling apart these different threads in terms of understanding the scale and impact of these types of incidents. And we do a special look into these third-party type and supply chain incidents, right? And, you know, the findings are going to be very interesting. I'm more than thrilled to come back and talk about it in detail.
Oh, you're invited.
Yeah, the impacts cascade, right? And this is, for attackers, it's very useful, right? Because, you know, we saw it, I think, in the early 2020s, MSPs were being targeted. Because they knew, you know, I get one MSP, I can get all their clients, right? And if I'm going to encrypt, I can get all of those, right? And we see something like, you know, over the course of a couple weekends ago, cPanel, right? There was a vulnerability in cPanel, which is like a backend management software that's used by a lot of hosting providers and things like that. That got compromised over the course of a weekend. So attackers looking once again at that level of economics. Third parties are extremely useful because they can provide you that venue into these larger organizations that A, have the funds and have the interest in terms of maintaining a good reputation. So, you know, you're exposing yourself if your third parties aren't kind of holding themselves to the same or similar standard as you are. And then the issue is exactly as Charity said, how can you maintain that accountability? How can you actually, you know, assure that these third parties are doing the right thing, and you know that they have a mutual understanding as to what the right thing is, and that they continue to do the right thing, right? These are very complex problems, and you know, I think we're going to continue to see this trend moving forward.
Absolutely. Well, I think, Tony, you know, I'll reflect on when we know about the third party. Let's move to AI shadow services when we have no idea. How am I going to govern this? Just referencing my partner in governance charity here as well. One of the issues we have is that there's a struggle, Phil, that I see with organizations trying to wrap their arms around how to govern, control AI capability within an organization. It's either embraced or there's a hesitancy, and you know, there's risks on both sides of that. But when I see organizations, and respectfully through the report itself, shadow enablement, as it were, through, well, if you're not going to provide me an AI capability, no problem. I'll just inside a threat that, and we'll go use another service outside of your control. Are we looking at a people problem, a process problem, a governance problem? What are you starting to see here, Phil?
The answer is yes, right? I think it's a big old ball of yarn that we have to start pulling, right? And you know, when we looked at the data, what, you know, specifically looking at these DLP providers or data loss providers, our main focus is looking at where data is, the type of data, and where does the data go. And what we found was that shadow AI became the third most common non-malicious insider type of investigation. So it showed up in 12% of these cases. And when it comes down to actually looking in terms of what type of data is being uploaded to these AI platforms, which to me, I think is the most complex part, we see everything, right? We saw the majority of it being source code with 28% is that the highest. But then you also saw images show up, right? That's a difficult thing to classify from like a DLP standpoint. PDFs, research and technical documents. Right, we've heard stories of folks that are working in research labs that have unpublished results, uploading their findings to these AI platforms and asking, you know, is there anything additional I should be doing? And then you take consideration, there goes your organization's intellectual property that you've invested, you know, months in developing, you know, right out the door. And the issue is that these AI platforms generate a lot of data. Right. And a lot of these third-party, you know, software as a service are also integrating AI into these platforms. So, you know, as a consumer, you know, the AI, the platform you once used now has AI enablement. What does that mean, right? What's being sent over? What's being stored? You know, are my prompts being stored? And all that stuff eventually can kind of end up being sensitive. When you start looking at a history, right? You're doing research on, you know, a potential merger. That can be a big, you know, implication for an organization, right? Maintaining a level of secrecy. So even the prompts and the questions you're asking can end up being sensitive. So, you know, we've seen this increase. We've seen that users are largely, you know, are still using a lot of their personal accounts for, you know, to access these Gen AI platforms. So in terms of whether it's a process or people or governance issue, it really starts at the top. I think there has to be, the organization has to make a decision as to what they're willing to support, and not taking a position as to, you know, these are the platforms we're willing to support, everything else gets blocked, is kind of a recipe for these AI bots to, you know, to show up and really kind of complicate things, right? Not know where your data is going. You know, I think we're seeing a little bit less of the meeting AI bots. Those were my favorite for a little while, where you would just have attendees that were just AI bots. And you're like, okay, well, you know, everything in this meeting is supposed to be safe harbor. Like, really, I don't think you should be having an AI bot in these, you know, because I don't know what that bot is. I've trusted your organization. I don't know how much trust you're putting into this organization that's now running the spot as well. So it's complicated, right? You know, I've always held the notion trust is personal, right? We have certain NDAs and things like that to make sure that we can share in a trusted environment. But, you know, these AI platforms are kind of opening up a little bit of that trust circle to these third parties that we may or may not have, like Charity said, any level of accountability on.
You know, the transference of trust is quickly lost there. Phil, let's go just briefly back to the kind of mechanics of the report, right? So as Sean mentioned at the beginning, you were a part of our team working on the control side, but then went over to Verizon and taking over the data analysis there. So tell about the role of CIS in contributing data, and then the things you have done to integrate the work that Charity's team does into the findings and into the recommendations.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's kind of three major buckets that CIS contributes to. So the first of which is the incident data. So MSISAC, being part of CIS, you know, they provide the forensic cases at a high level, anonymized to us, which really helps us understand what's happening in the SLTT community. So that gets integrated into our incident corpus, if you will, right? Gets an ingredient that gets put in the cake, becomes part of the DBIR cake. So that really kind of has been a tremendous amount of help, because this is a largely underrepresented demographic, especially considering some of the small sizes of municipalities. So that's the first. The second of which is, you know, we tie back our patterns and recommendations to the CIS controls. This is something that was done actually prior to me being on the team, I think for a couple iterations. Tony, I think you were there in the legacy days. But since I've joined on, we've really tried and made an effort to make that kind of part of baked into our discussion, right? And one of the reasons why is, we're a small team, right? We're four people, and we can't be experts on everything, right? Being experts on the cutting edge technology and all the changes in controls and software and recommendations is very challenging. And plus, anytime we would make a recommendation, someone else would pipe in and be like, well, what about this thing? Or if only you did these things, everything would have been solved. So it ends up being extremely beneficial to have a community supported and vetted framework that we can point to. We can be like, the community says these are the things organizations should prioritize, right? So when we're looking in terms of the recommendations in the DBIR, right, we tie it back to a larger IG1. Because we really do believe this is the foundation. And, you know, it's one of these challenges with the report is we want to write to folks that aren't just cybersecurity experts, right? We try to have it to be, you know, acceptable by, you know, lawyers and, you know, asset owners and business owners and, you know, who have you, so they can kind of get some takeaways that's also valuable. And I think being able to tie back to IG1 really provides that grounding foundation, right? Where it's not just about technology. It's not about flipping a switch or buying a shiny box. It's really about these processes that exist. And then the last one, which is kind of these special research areas. So something that I was extremely interested in pursuing this year and that we end up publishing is looking at the routes to privilege escalation. So, and this was really something that was prompted when I started looking at some of the correspondence of Conti. So Conti was a ransomware group that after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there was some level of animosity between the operators and, you know, the group. So there was kind of a split, and someone leaked all their internal conversations, right? Which included a manual that said, you know, well, once you have access to the environment, you know, to your target environment, you should really just be looking for misconfigurations and directory services or known vulnerabilities or these weak passwords. And that's all they say. They say two or three sentences. And it kind of hit me, but it can't be that simple, right? It can't be, you know, that this is the goal. It's like, once you're in, you're really just looking for issues with configuration, permissions, patches, and passwords. So that was kind of what I wanted to tackle, was to use MITRE's attack as kind of this underpinning and say, okay, I have a whole collection of incident data. I have data on threat intelligence. I have data on blah, blah, blah. What are attackers doing? And then I want to contrast that to how many of these techniques tie back to weaknesses and passwords, configurations, patches, or permissions. So CIS ended up being incredibly useful for that because it allowed me to tie back the benchmarks, right? The actual configuration elements to something like Kerber roasting. I know Kerber roasting is popular, right? And these are the configuration elements that allow Kerber roasting to happen. So we've been kind of tying this together to really provide and help organizations, you know, identify this linkage that exists, right? It's not just about closing the gaps that exists in your, you know, your vulnerabilities in the sense like, oh, you know, I haven't patched X, Y, and Z, but it's really about this trade-off that you have to make between your secure configurations and your permissions and how you architect your environment. And you may not be aware that you're making this trade-off, right? Because people that are doing the secure, you know, setup for the domain controller may not be aware that if RC4 is enabled, right, that makes it easy for attackers to brute force or, you know, crack the credentials because it's a weak ciphers. So I've been kind of trying to tie these elements together. I'm really going to be interested to see what the reaction response to this is, because I think I've only really scratched the surface. And I think there's a lot more that we can do to kind of pull that thread.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's one thing to be a data scientist, Phil, but also a cybersecurity expert and bring those two together. Phenomenal. So as you do more research, yes, you're coming back. Yes, we want to hear about it. And it's another episode. So just laying that out there for whenever you're
ready. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm happy to do two more if you want. I'm happy to do two more episodes, right? We have the impact report coming out in June, and then we can do a deep dive in terms of this analysis I did.
Brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. Charity, I just wanted to finish off the episode by thinking, as we start to see this data, we start to see the results of the Verizon Data Breach Investigation Report, and we start to think about actions that can be taken, the results of that analysis. But then also one I just wanted to dive into is, how does this then affect, let's say, the new version of the controls? As we see this data, we see the threat environment. And, you know, we've got advice, we've got new AI guidance that we're publishing. How does that all evolve into, one, actionable steps? And then two, how does this reframe your approach to the controls?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are definitely forward looking at, you know, the evolution of the controls themselves, and certainly heavily lean upon the strategic partnership that we have with Verizon and their Intel report that they provide every year. We, like Phil said, we work together to map those top attacks. You know, what do we know? We know the top attacks. We look at those together. What are we going to do about it, right? We're going to map it to protections and really understand the prioritization, right, for the different implementation groups. And so that is absolutely, absolutely ongoing. Now, as far as any of this new data for AI-enabled attacks, certainly something that we're going to have to look at over the next, you know, certainly the rest of this year. There won't be a new version of the controls this year, but we're looking towards a potential for the next year and really taking all of this data in, right, and understanding how it applies to the evolution of the controls themselves and our protections, right? We stand on that prioritization. One other thing, we took a look at all of this data in a new version of the community defense model as well, which should be coming soon, where we introduce a kill chain model. We took the data-driven prioritization from CDM 2.0 and really expanded it to map safeguards to stages of an attack. So the team can focus investments on where they matter most and use it as a practical gap analysis for planning and budgeting. So really, we've evolved the community defense model. So we have a lot of things on the horizon. But as far as actionable steps, and I have so many, but I'm going to try to keep this very succinct. I sound like a broken record, but nail the basics first. Know what devices and software you actually have. This is the importance of your asset inventory. I cannot stress that enough. Using secure configurations like the benchmarks, it's the number one protection that we see in the CDM research when evaluating protections against attack patterns, and it's by far. And then, you know, patch the things we already know are being exploited in the wild. This is a change you can enforce now, and it needs to be treated as critical, right? Make it harder for the attacker to take over your accounts. Use MFA and clean up old accounts. And then make ransomware less scary. We talked about ransomware, right? Keep privileges tight. Keep protected backups and actually test those restores so you know that you can recover. I didn't cover it in the question before, but to me, ransomware touches on, any threat that we're talking about touches on the confidence of being able to recover, right? The importance of having incident response and a solid business continuity plan and being able to recover from those backups. So a lot to say as the close, but yeah, those are some key takeaways from me, Sean.
Brilliant. Thank you, Charity. Well, we could go on again another couple hours to get through everything that we could talk about at this, you know, very small topic. But again, Phil, Charity, thank you so much. Again, the partnership, collaboration, obviously the DBIR, fundamental, an anchor to the cybersecurity community. So congratulations. And if to our audience, if you haven't downloaded it, it is available. Please download. It is a treasure trove of information that is going to help support your cybersecurity program in the future. Cool. Tony, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. And to our audience, thank you so much. Make sure to subscribe in all the usual ways with your preferred podcast provider. Questions, comments, concerns, reach out to us at podcast@cisecurity.org. Catch us on YouTube at The CI Security. And with that, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.